been a searing, traumatic week for our country. We've been challenged by the President to use this occasion for reflection. We should embrace the opportunity. If any good can emerge from wanton violence and death, it is that we might become a little bit more appreciative of the lives that are ours and of the country that we love. By focusing attention on Christina Green, the 9-year-old girl buried today, President Obama forced us to think of our own children and other people's children. Inevitably, we are compelled to consider society's responsibilities towards those who are in our sacred trust. By dwelling on Dorwin Stoddard, who died while shielding his wife with his own body, we are drawn to reflecting on our own parents and grandparents. We are encouraged to consider the value of love, courage, devotion, and marriage. By remembering Judge Roll, we are compelled to think of all jurists who uphold the law in defense of our democratic union. By praying for the health of Congresswoman Giffords, we are compelled to consider all public officials who work diligently and seek the welfare of this country. But the task of reflection should be as deep and as searing as the events themselves. It is all too facile and all too lazy to be satisfied with what passes today for reflection. The call to rise above partisanship, incivility, and heated rhetoric, that is all too easy. It means nothing. It's just words. Public reflection is irrelevant unless we share with each other that which we are reflecting about. We should be embarking on a serious and passionate public debate about the ease with which a deranged individual can walk into a store and buy a weapon that can kill dozens in seconds. Until we do this, we will know that the calls to reflection are falling on deaf ears. After all, since the massacre in Tucson 6 days ago, hundreds of Americans whose lives are no less valuable than the ones in Tucson have been killed through gun violence. Passion is not the problem. Lack of passion on the part of the silent majority is the problem. Seems to me that at these moments in our personal and national lives, spiritual leaders can help advance the discussion by drawing upon our religious traditions. Why do we do these things? What compels us? What drives us? If we can understand better who we are, then we can indeed continually advance towards a more perfect union. So allow me to share with you some thoughts about how our faith might inform our public reflections. One, we human beings are a baffling mixture, a potent combination of good and bad. In truth, we are destroyers as well as creators. We are killers as well as healers. We have malignant hearts and broad hearts. We are self-centered and empathetic. We are cruel and kind. We are ugly and beautiful. We are agents of war and of peace. We are creatures of the night who strive towards the light. Jewish sages reminded us that we are made of crooked timber and that such crooked timber cannot be made completely straight. We have this struggle going on inside of us. It is an unrelenting civil war between the Yetzer HaTov, the good impulse, and the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse. We need to know that about ourselves. We need to accept ourselves. Judaism teaches that while we cannot eliminate these impulses entirely, we can get better at putting a lid on them. We can increasingly master them. We can tame these impulses over time and control ourselves better. Two, putting a lid on our impulses requires a personal mindset and a social system that encourages maximum freedom together with personal and social responsibility. That is the lesson of our Torah portion. The Israelites crossed the Red Sea into the vast desert of freedom, and the first thing that Moses did was to direct them straight to Mount Sinai so that they may assume the burden of law and social responsibility. Freedom did not mean do whatever you want. Freedom meant assuming responsibilities for yourself and for others. We are our brother's keeper. Because we cannot fully master ourselves, and because we are deeply flawed, Judaism encouraged, in fact insisted, that we avoid certainties and absolutes. The middle path, said Maimonides, is the place to be. Not too extreme on one side or the other. Passion is not the problem. And even partisanship is not the problem. Our tradition is one long, remarkable 2,000-year record of disagreement after disagreement, controversy after controversy, and dispute after dispute, passionately argued, often with deep partisanship. Nothing great was ever achieved without passion. The human craving for absolutes, for certainty, for monopoly on truth, this is the problem. Our intolerance of others' ideas and our difficulties in accepting that we may be wrong, these are the problems. Our inability to internalize that social and moral goods might conflict, and they may not be fully reconcilable. That the social goods served by your raising cattle without government intrusion may not be fully reconcilable with the social good of my eating a hamburger without getting sick. This is the problem. And it is for this reason, over and over again, in words as well as in systems, Judaism insisted on a basic pluralism that allowed people to disagree and work out their disagreements in a passionate but peaceful way. Our sages recognized that the world is much too complicated for one person or one nation to understand. We don't even understand ourselves very well. How can we claim to understand a country of 300 million people? The problem in our country is not partisanship. The problem is not passion. The problem is absolutism. It is an undeserved confidence in certainty and truth that is incompatible with human nature. There are no absolutes in human affairs. Everything is filtered through human understanding and human emotion, and thus subject to the basic human condition of imperfection. If you believe that you possess the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, then everyone else is wrong, at best, and at worst is your evil enemy. If you possess absolute truth, you are impervious to discussion and debate. It is simply impossible to have a dialogue and be influenced by others, and this is the basic assumption of democracies and pluralism. Because the other person is not simply wrong, he is evil. The other person is not one of us. His motives are malicious. He is out to undermine our freedom, our American liberty, and wants to create death panels to eliminate your mother. That person is illegitimate, beyond the pale. The president is not only wrong, he is wholly other, alien, whose primary intention is to march us towards tyranny. The problem in our country is not even heated rhetoric. It is overheated self-confidence in our capacity to know with certainty what is right and what is wrong. This is an intellectual straitjacket. We are imprisoned in a dungeon of ideological darkness where no natural light can penetrate. Doesn't mean that we cannot speak of truths, that we cannot hold certain truths to be self-evident. Freedom is better and morally superior to slavery. This we learn from our Torah. Human happiness is better than human misery. Dignity is better than deprivation. Democracy is better than tyranny. Millennia of wisdom, history, experience, reason, discernment, moral judgment, insight, and intuition have taught us these self-evident truths. They have taught us to distinguish between the arsonist and the fireman. We know the difference between murder and self-defense. We do not need to claim human perfection to make the distinction. Human judgment, such as it exists now, is enough. But how these principles apply to the millions of daily details of our national lives is an exceedingly complicated endeavor. We should be humble in our assumptions. We cannot put ourselves in the mind of God, or even worse, replace the mind of God. 3. This country is a good country. Its people are decent and kind. Americans pursue happiness, not bloodshed. Americans incline towards peace, not war. We gravitate towards moderation, not polarization. We are centrists, not extremists. We are pluralists, not fundamentalists. We are optimistic. We believe in progress. We believe not in complaining, but in solving problems. We believe in initiative, hard work, and charity. American institutions and our founding ideas are the envy of the world. It is not that we are free of problems. We have many challenges and festering unresolved imperfections. But it is easy to lose perspective, especially during these days of national trauma. Take a virtual tour around the world and tell me, in what country would you prefer to live? Tell me what country provides its citizens with more promise and more potential for human happiness. Tell me what country is more indispensable to the peace and welfare of the world. With all of the searing and severe problems of medical care in this country, still, think of the amazing hospital that those wounded people were taken to, the skill of the surgeons, the compassion of the nurses, and the religious and ethnic diversity of the medical staff. In a hospital in suburban Tucson, some have suggested that there is a fundamental instability, a fatal flaw, some deadly seeds planted years ago and growing under the American landscape. I do not believe this. I believe that we are still progressing, still evolving, and still the last best hope on earth. National progress is measured in decades, not in days. And looking back across the decades, I believe that we are a better country now than in decades past. This is Martin Luther King weekend. Think of the state of race relations now and compare that to the days of the Montgomery bus boycott and Rosa Parks. We're still not perfect, but we have made extraordinary progress. As a nation, we have not yet reached the promised land, but we have not deviated from the path either. And finally, 4. Our Torah portion describes the first steps that the Israelites took towards the promised land. The journey would take decades. It was hard and unforgiving. The founding generation would not live to see the promised land. As soon as the people began walking, literally their first steps from the Red Sea, the Bible describes their mood. We read, they went on into the wilderness. They walked for 3 days and found no water, and the people began grumbling. They came to a place called Marah, but they could not drink the water. And then the Hebrew text states as follows, Velo yachlu lishtot maim mimarah kimarim hem. And the people could not drink the water because they were bitter. Since the Hebrew word for water, maim, is plural, and the Hebrew phrase for the people of Israel is also plural, Jewish sages asked what was bitter, the water or the people? Is it that the people couldn't drink the water because the water was bitter? Or is it that the water was undrinkable because the people were bitter? One tradition states, it was the people who were bitter, not the water. And because the people were bitter, everything they tasted and everything they felt was bitter. What a profound lesson on life. We must guard against bitterness and pessimism. We must guard against loathing and objectification of the other. If we are bitter, everything that we taste and everything that we feel and all the people we come into contact will be bitter. If the American people become embittered, our institutions and our ethos that took centuries to build can come crashing down in short order. It is our optimism and beliefs that sustain the American dream. The dream will become a nightmare if the people become embittered. Let us do as Moses urged the ancient Israelites. Keep our eyes focused on the next step. Keep our vision on the horizon towards the promised land. And then the waters and life itself will be sweet.